Accession number 17840, Reel 3.
Arthur Morris, Reel 3. Did you take any German prisoners at 112?
To my knowledge, we took none on here 112.
Did you see any yourself there?
No, they had disappeared by the time we had gone over the little river in the valley. I think they had in front of us as we were approaching here 112. I think by virtue of the numbers that they saw coming on towards them, I think they picked up their pieces and went as far as they could and as quickly as they could. We had taken no prisoner.
At Hill 112, did you see anything of the neighbouring British regiments, like the Cornwall?
Yes, we saw the Cornwall Light Infantry in the woods to our right, milling around in the actual small copse.
Anything else you saw of them?
No, very little. It was a sort of a contained unit, the same as us, we were, as the Somersets. We were contained, more or less responsible for the area which we had taken and held. Ours was Hill 112, in actual fact, was a cornfield during the summer. And so we had the difficulties of approaching it. Of course, while the corn was actually growing, it was about four foot high when we got there, so it was a bit more difficult, really, for us with respect to the others. But we didn't know what to expect until we had got in the cornfield.
Were there any French civilians around?
None at all. None at all.
What happened when the breakthrough came at 112?
Well, we obviously moved on to other villages in the area, and by the time that we arrived onto those villages, that was going towards the town of Caen, C-A-E-N, which was somewhere around 12 kilometres away from Hill 112, approximately. You could see the outskirts of Caen from Hill 112, looking back, as against looking forward to the sea. So there was very little that the Germans or British that you could see. You could hear the tanks milling around and all that sort of thing, but you saw very few Germans after we had been on there for, say, a week or so. They had disappeared into the valley and had moved on to their respective areas for pulling back, knowing that the numbers were far greater that they had to contend with.
Did the 4th Somersets continue in action beyond 112, or did they go into reserve?
Oh, no, they moved on to surrounding villages for a period of overnight or maybe up to afternoon, and then old groups, which was known as a sort of conversing thing between the platoon commanders, company commander, platoon commanders, and down to section commanders, section leaders, as to what the next move was. And from Hill 112, it was quite open, really. There was very little. Germans had moved back overnight, over a short period, a week or so, and they were some miles away by the time we had really got really moving after Hill 112. They'd commonly known as scarpered a bit quick and got back. Obviously for their own sakes, to reform and whatever they considered they wanted to do, either to counterattack or not, which they didn't anyway. And eventually we would catch up with them at some other battle, maybe 10, 15, 20 miles away. It wasn't such a war as, under those circumstances there, where you had to battle all the way to take the ground.
Can you take me through what happened to you in the rest of the Normandy campaign, please?
Well, my recollection of it, of course, is rather difficult in that it all happened so quickly, and eventually the Germans had moved back again so quickly that we had to jump on our own tanks, 15 or as many as one could get, as a platoon or two platoons to two tanks, and move back en route to sort of catch up with the Germans. They were moving so quickly away, having given it up as a bad job and knowing very well that they didn't have the numbers to contend with the vast flow of British troops that were coming, remembering and taking in consideration that all this time that we were on Hill 1-2, other troops were coming ashore at Arromanches to build up the force. So it meant that other troops, other regiments were passing through us just beyond Hill 1-2 and carrying on to the next form of attack. So it was interchangeable, so to speak, one going through the other. And this is how the whole period, I would say, on reflection, went on after that. I mean, sometimes we would have to get on our soft vehicles, skin-type vehicles, like three-ton vehicles, one-ton vehicles, or open, which we did invariably, light infantry. You jumped on the tanks, and the tanks advanced. Not through country that was held by the Germans, it was through country that they'd vacated in their getting back out the way.
Which armoured unit were you working with?
Oh, I can't tell you which one now, but all I can say is that the vehicles themselves were mostly Churchills, large Churchills, which were quite open to being used as fodder by the German anti-tank gunners, because with their 88 millimeters, they were quite a force, which we rather hated, the old 88 millimeter guns, for more than one reason, because they had anti-personnel shells, which when they fired them, of course, they exploded, and it was the thousands of bits of shrapnel which they were filled with that done all the wounds, and therefore you were really on the receiving end if they used this particular type of gun.
Was that the most feared German weapon?
Well, I think so, myself. It's a type of weapon that you can't do very much about it. They're fired at you, and the only thing you can do is to, if you're in a trench, is to stay down until you hear them cease shooting, and then hope that everything's all right when you put your head up over it again. But failing that, the weapons that the Germans had during the war were always very, very good. Their machine guns seem to have been a lot faster working than British guns. I'm talking about like the Bren gun and our machine gun, which was a good gun in itself, but I don't think it did not have the quickness of the shots as they did the German army had.
How did relations go between the British infantry and the armour? Were there any frictions between them?
No, they were very, very helpful. For instance, if you were going from point A to B, and the commander thought, well, we're not going to, there's no problem, we got no Germans between us and so, obviously it had to be an organised thing. But either the tank commander said to the platoon commander or company commander of the infantry, we're going so far up, it's all clear as far as you're concerned. If you want to jump on, jump on. And it was a thing left to the discretion of the commander in charge, actually, whether he accepted it or not. If he was not allowed or told by the commanding officer, I'm afraid when I say on foot, it's on foot. Or failing that, if you think and deem it necessary to get on for because your troops are shattered or what, leg-worthy, then, yeah, by all means. But it wasn't an accepted thing. It was a possibility that they would give you a lift if you wanted it. But we had a very good friendship with the Panzers and our tank people.
Once you were promoted to sergeant, what did your job then become in Normandy?
Platoon sergeant. Invariably, you were the top person in the platoon because young officers, subalterns, seemed to have be the first ones to get picked on and wounded. It was one of those things in life. If you can knock off the top one, of course you take the guts out of the platoon, so to speak. And by doing that, you degrade their thoughts, and they got a problem on their hands. So I think in this case, you're so quick in saying, oh, well, you know, there are certain things I want to mention it, that you don't, although they say a leader is always the man that's in the front, that's not always the case, of course, because invariably your platoon commander would be just a section behind the front in any case. For natural reasons, he's the man that knows what has got to be done. He has been given the orders by the company commander through his old group that they have to take a certain spot. And you may elect, as a young subaltern officer, that they're making for a particular point in the battle, but then you also got to take in consideration that it's no good telling every soldier that particular knowledge, otherwise he's liable to, what can I say, object. He can't very well object, of course that's not the right word, but he doesn't feel so happy when he knows all the true story. It's every good British soldier is happy to receive orders, and that's how it's always been. I think, in fairness, that they accept what comes. They don't want to know all the ins and outs of it. It's worries that they got, which they don't necessarily really want. That's the truth of it.
But why can the enemy pick off the subalterns and not pick off the platoon sergeants?
Well, this again is due to, during our battle in the main, officers do not wear any stars on their shoulder. So they, in other words, they, apart from their berry or what have you, headdress, they don't wear any distinguishing marks any more than a sergeant, really, in the front line troops. He doesn't wear it because everybody in his platoon knows who he is, respect the fact that he is the platoon sergeant or corporal or officer, and therefore they don't need to wear the rank.
And yet the subalterns were being picked off even so, even though they took the precautions to disguise themselves.
Yes, on occasions. It happened not too often, but on occasions. For instance, they might have been watched, as an example, from a distance through binoculars, giving orders through an O group. And they know the kingpin in four or five, because he's doing all the talking, so they assume that he is the one that knows all what's going on. And that's how I see is they pick those type of people out.
How did you like being a sergeant of a platoon?
Well, I don't think it's a case of did I like it. I don't think I enjoyed it any more than the others. It's a case of I respected that a job had to be done. I had been given the job to do, and in a battle, you're equal. It's not a case of discipline like it is on a barrack square. It's a different type of discipline. It's an affectionate way of staying together as a body. And they understand, the troops understand that. They know that someone has got to give the orders, and they accept it in the main from the people that have been put in position as such.
Which platoon did you have?
I think it was... I think it was a number... I'm not absolutely sure, because... It doesn't. It's so long ago, and I just cannot remember the platoons now.
But it was 4 Company. It was B Company.
It was B Company, yes. So it would have been normally 3 companies platoons to a company. It would have been sort of 5 or 6, something like that.
Now, coming back to the story, you were pushing fast away out of Normandy into France.
Mm-hmm.
Can you take it on from there, please?
Well, we went sort of round Caen, which was the big city nearest to Arromanches, and once we got beyond Caen, it was a case of the Germans had advanced, or retreated is the word, had retreated so quickly that then they started lifting British troops on our tanks for long distances, especially during the night time. Obviously they had to take chances, but knowing what the situation was during the day through the few planes that we had flying above and our fighters having a good look out the front, knew, must have known that they had retreated back 10 miles or 20 miles. Then we started, in turn, getting on the tanks as infantrists and being driven up for a considerable number of miles during darkness, so that we then were dropped off at a distance from the Germans and dug in or had taken up residence in old farmhouses, farm huts, whatever you were, or normal houses, and because there were no civilians in the areas then. I mean, they'd all been shelved away, or they had decided to go long before. There were very few civilians in the areas that we covered as the Somerset Light Infantry, right the way up to the big cities. So, you know, they had means of getting them back, or putting them in some form of camp or something like that, which were not direct under shell fire, etc., etc.
Can you take me through the advance that you then made?
Well, the advance in the main, after the Caen area, it was mostly done by covering runs on tanks, and then dropping off if we found that we had pockets of resistance, which we thought we would be able to deal with more or less on the spot, then would we be off maybe for a few hours. And if it was a small pocket, then we would take them prisoner and lead them to the people coming up behind, because it was always the same old thing. People moved up from the rear. There was never a big gap between front and rear, so that more that moved up tight behind us, the more people were coming in from Arromanches to filter out and cover the ground that we had taken. So it was then, when we started well inside of France, that we were doing the long runs on tanks.
What state were the German prisoners in?
Well, they had literally had enough. But they, of course... as I think was fairly known by troops, they're not easy people to give in. They don't give in at everything, but neither do they take silly chances. I remember the small pockets of resistance that we got, even when we thought we had more or less secured an area. We still seemed to get troubled by the Germans. The more we got into Germany,
into
France, and into Holland and places like that, then they seemed to have longer areas of no activity, and therefore the Germans moved back, retreated quite quickly into areas that they knew, had known so well for the number of years that the war was on, 5 years or 4 years. So we caught up with them eventually in different places, you know, places that don't really register at the moment, that would come to light as a specific place. I mean, when you think that some of our bigger battles in the Somerset Light Infantry came at places like Elst, near Arnhem. But we had gone on so fast, so quickly, on tanks, and gone to a place where we knew there might be some difficulty to find a great pocket of resistance.
Did you personally go through Brussels?
No, we bypassed big towns. We had no big towns, really.
So where were you by the time Arnhem came?
Well, we went through Nijmegen, as they say, and I always remember the area of Elst, which I was in as a platoon sergeant. Elst was a place between a railway, not actually, it was a part of it, but there was a railway and a road with about a distance of 50 yards, 50 metres, I suppose, between two. Both. And there was a little farmhouse in there which gave us quite a bit of trouble as we were coming from Nijmegen Bridge. And I always remember the bridge at Nijmegen, in actual fact, because there was a German body actually hanging on the top of the bridge itself. He must have been up there as a outlook man, posted as a outlooker with his binoculars or what, and got shot while he was up there. But he was obviously dead, just hanging on top of the bridge. But you can't do anything about things like that. That's a part of war, and so you bypass it. So we went over the bridge on foot, and then moved on from... That was at a place called on the outskirts of Nijmegen, and onwards to Elst, which is about, if I remember rightly, somewhere about 5 kilometres towards Arnhem. And Arnhem Bridge is probably another 5 kilometres from Elst. But the railway road ran to the right, railway to the left, and they gradually moved in like that to the bridges at Arnhem over the Rhine.
What happened to you at Elst?
With Elst, I was the forward left platoon between the railway and the line and the road in front of an apple orchard. That's where we took up position. We got one attack there whilst we were in that position, and in actual fact, we had a farmhouse area where we, during the day when everything was quiet, the Germans, we considered, was no nearer than Arnhem from us. But they sent their scouts out and their patrols back to see what things were happening, what was happening behind them, or in front of them, whichever position they were in. But having done so, we had one or two little skirmishes there, and... they used this type of tank, infantry tank weapon, which bashed a hole. They fired at it and bashed a hole in the outer building. As I had just gone in, to have a cup of tea that had been made by one of the platoon, only to find, once I was around the back there, only to find a big bang and a load of smoke and dust and a hole in the wall. So, of course, straight away, I dropped what I had, tea, whatever it was, and out I went. And there were one German, which we took prisoner, and our chaps were still in the trenches, just keeping their eye open, because they didn't see him come through the orchard, obviously. But he, the German man, soldier, must have been quite... with ease at the area. He had obviously been stationed there and knew the ways in through the orchard, and fired this shot, whatever it was, like a small bazooka type anti-tank weapon, and made this hole in the wall. And I mean, it really, really shook us up, of course. After that, he was taken prisoner, and I think we never question these types of fellows anyway, not in the infantry. I mean, they're sent back behind for questioning. But then we found that we had to send out light patrols after that towards the bridge, just to see who was milling about in between, or if there's anybody had retreated back from Arnhem, to keep an eye on what we were doing. But we had no problem after that. And eventually, we moved forward. We didn't move into Arnhem ourselves, but we moved south and went over the Weser near a place called Wesel, V-E-S-E-L, which had its bridge broken down, bombed. So the Germans couldn't sort of get back. They could get over the Arnhem Bridge, but they couldn't get over anyone of the other two or three down the Rhine from there, because it had already been bombed. So after that, things began to thin out quite considerably as far as the German forces were concerned. They knew, I think, at this time that they had a beating, and they just made for their homeland, I think, because we found very little response to our attacks on any place, really, after Arnhem. Very few worries did we have, I think. So one or two little skirmishes from outlying places farther down the Rhine. And I remember we met up with the Americans at some stage, which was near a place called Gelsenkirchen, which was where, what in actual fact, the Americans had battled for and taken. And when we met up with them, I always remember as it was today, when we were invited in to have a cup of tea in one of their buildings, only to find, as we said, typical Yanks, they had white cloths on the tables to have their sandwiches, etc., and their candles stuck in a